You're on Team Human, clearing a path for conscious beings in an automated landscape. This is where we challenge the assumptions underlying our markets, our media, and our machines, and look towards sustainable solutions, social connection, and re-enchantment with the natural world. Human awareness is not a computational phenomenon. We are real. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and I'm on Team Human. Playing for Team Human today, Professor Richard Barbrook, social historian, labor activist, and technology critic.
Well, what we don't want to be told is when we're being selling our wage labor to create surplus value for the capitalist class, that somehow it is, you know, creating the Gaia mind. No, it isn't. It's capitalism, mate.
Best known for his breakthrough essay, The California Ideology, Richard will be deconstructing the current technopolitical landscape and sharing with us new paths to resistance. It's time to intervene on behalf of people. You're on Team Human. Just a year ago, proposing a concept like universal basic income, where everyone is guaranteed a minimum subsidy from the government, could practically get me laughed off the stage at a tech industry conference. It seemed to go against every fundamental tenet of the creative destruction characterizing the digital economy. Don't reward the obsolete. Force them to evolve. If people lose their jobs to automation, they should be retrained for new ones. You know, from the perspective of Silicon Valley's executives, only a hippie or a communist would suggest that people be given a livable wage simply for being alive. But for me, having just published Throwing Rocks at the Google Bus about the lopsided returns of the digital economy and all the anger that it was generating among San Franciscans displaced by gentrification, a guaranteed minimum income seemed to be an obvious solution to a problem first posed back in the 1950s by the inventor of cybernetics, Norbert Wiener. What would happen when the robots he was enabling would be able to till the fields and render human labor obsolete? Would we humans seize the opportunity to lay down on the beach and sip lemonade while our mechanical servants provided for our needs? Or would a paucity of employment opportunities throw our entire economy into chaos with humans perpetually competing for work against their more efficient and tireless mechanical peers? In fact, we already live in a highly automated world filled with technologies capable of producing more stuff than we can possibly use. Think of it. In America, companies compete for consumers and dispose of the stuff they can't sell. Many of us have storage units for the possessions we can't fit into our homes. We're living in such abundance with such a supply-side glut that right now we're tearing down houses that are in foreclosure and burning surplus agriculture. By our current way of thinking, we can't just let people live in those houses or eat the food because they don't have jobs through which to earn the income to pay for them. But consider that logic for just a minute. We don't need to employ people in order to get some work done. We don't need more lawnmowers or vehicles. We'll need even fewer once we start sharing them with simple apps or common pools of some kind. No, we need to create jobs for people so that we can justify letting them enjoy the stuff we already have in abundance. So in such an environment, simply letting people have the things they need or a guaranteed income, entitling them to the basics like food, housing, and healthcare, it seems an obvious solution. If people want luxuries beyond that, they can compete for work or get more entrepreneurial. It's an idea that was first floated in America by none other than Richard Nixon in the form of a negative income tax for the poor. And as I explained in the book, study after study has shown that a guaranteed income doesn't lead to laziness. The financial safety it affords actually leads individuals to take greater creative risks. And that's why I should have been glad this past spring when developers at Uber began to ask me about universal basic income. I'd just delivered a talk in which I blamed the company for extracting all the value out of the taxicab market without any real intent of making it sustainable. In my view, and this is the real view, they were simply using the cab market as a beachhead in their bigger battle to monopolize all transportation and logistics, just like Amazon used books as a foothold into retail with little regard to the effect on authors or publishers. And to my surprise, the Uber people acknowledged the impact of their company and then brought up UBI, Universal Basic Income, as a possible solution. Wouldn't that let us keep going, one employee asked me. So while I should have been thrilled that the workers and leaders of some of our biggest Silicon Valley firms, from these folks at Uber to similar audiences I've met at Facebook and Google, that they finally jumped aboard the universal basic income bandwagon, I don't know, my encounters with these people so far, with this new breed of UBI advocate, has convinced me that they're doing it with much less altruistic ambitions, and that their plans will lead to entirely less benevolent outcomes. They understand the basic math undermining their long-term business plans. If they automate all the jobs, who will be left to buy their services? Even the data that companies such as Google mine from our otherwise free online activities will be worthless if we have no money to spend. The penniless have no consumer behavior to exploit. So it's as if these firms want to be able to destroy people's jobs in the name of bottom line efficiency while still depending on those very people they've unemployed to serve as consumers for their products. Why let joblessness impede corporate growth? If the people have no wage wealth to extract, then let government print money for them to spend. So I'll admit it's gratifying to hear a multi-billionaire like Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg echoing the words in my books as he asks graduating Harvard students to figure out a universal basic income strategy for America. But in light of the rest of Facebook's priorities and behavior, his request comes off as utterly clueless and a little more than late. It seems less like a comprehensive economic vision than a guilt-inspired effort to compensate for the social impact of his own businesses, much like his intention to donate 99% of his Facebook shares to charity over the course of his life. If you have to donate 99% of your winnings, maybe you took too much to begin with. It's as if by dropping out of college himself to pursue his social media startup, he missed the courses in civics, economics, liberal arts, and sociology that may have prevented him and his company from becoming part of America's economic problem rather than its solution. And I'd have an easier time accepting his proposal at face value if Facebook weren't spending so much effort avoiding paying tax on its massive profits. Where's universal basic income supposed to come from if not the profits that the companies have made by cutting out human labor in the first place? Likewise, the Uber employees I spoke with sounded genuinely concerned about the many drivers they hope to replace with robot vehicles. They were aware of the irony of Uber drivers being used to train the algorithms that would soon drive cars without human participation, and they hoped that universal basic income could somehow solve the joblessness problem that they were themselves creating. But underlying all of these second thoughts and compensatory strategies is a short-sighted faith in the inevitability of technology's conquest over mankind. By focusing single-mindedly on the efficiency of his code and algorithms, the technophiles of Silicon Valley have engendered a business culture that values speed and efficiency over everything else. Yet it's only in such an environment that robots win out over humans. Sure, a robot may be able to do my job better than I do, but since when are jobs the only way for people to contribute value to our society and economy? In fact, employment as we know it is a rather recent artifact of the industrial age. It only came into being when small businesses were outlawed by the establishment of the chartered monopoly, or what we now think of as the corporation. Only sanctioned monopolies were allowed to function in particular industries, and former small business owners were forced to travel to cities to work as employees of larger companies. So instead of creating and exchanging value directly, people worked for an hourly wage. Time became money, and the job became a way of measuring value as some function of productivity per hour. Of course machines are better at that. That's why, to me anyway, it's ironic to hear so much anxiety about robots and algorithms taking away people's jobs and the difficulty we're going to have inventing new jobs for the displaced. The solution may be less a matter of how to find jobs for people than challenging the underlying assumption that jobs are themselves necessary for the vast majority of people in a healthy economy. Who wants a job anyway? We want stuff. We want to exchange value and create meaning. But jobs were not invented for that purpose. Neither is industrial efficiency the best North Star for a human society and economy transitioning from an industrial to a digital age. Instead of exploring the possibilities unleashed by digital technology to retrieve the independent value creation and peer-to-peer networks repressed by early corporatism, we're doubling down on the industrial age values of growth and efficiency, as well as its willingness to externalize the worst of its effects. We argue more about saving jobs that computers and smartphones may replace than ending the slave labor that goes into their mining and manufacture. Were we to approach technology development from the perspective of human welfare rather than looking at such problems after the fact, we may come to realize that efficiencies for the bottom line often translate into grave consequences for everyone else. Adam Smith argued that in any healthy economy, we need to embrace all three factors of production: land, labor, and capital. Right now, Silicon Valley recognizes the importance of only capital. Investors get a seat at the table in the boardroom, while the places and workers being exploited do not. That's how an otherwise promising digital economy instead accelerates both climate change and the disenfranchisement of labor. Only capital scales infinitely the way digital platforms demand. The real world cannot compete. Maybe we need more people making this stuff at higher wages and less efficiently in order to take the planet and its people into consideration. Throwing them money after the fact may be better than nothing, but it's not a sustainable solution to the problem of digital companies conceived on the presumption of extractive, perpetual growth. They will still necessarily take more than they give. Please don't forget to join our ranks as deliberately as you can, and support this show and the people working to bring it to you by going to teamhuman.fm and clicking on support. That will bring you to our Patreon page at patreon.com/teamhuman, where you could become a member of the show, get your signed membership card, access to our Slack channel where you can suggest guests and topics, discuss the show and its ideas with other members of the team, get free premium, signed books, access to special audio, video, works in progress, and most of all, one another.
I'm L.A. Kaufman, and I'm on Team Human.
I'm Mushan Zeraviv, and I'm on Team Human.
My name is Walter Kern, and I'm on Team Human.
I'm Sylvia Zier, and I'm on Team Human.
I am Tessa Lena, and I'm on Team Human.
We're Team Human, coming to you, alive, from the Basement Laboratory for Digital Humanism at CUNY Queens College, and online at teamhuman.fm.
Hi, this is Steven. Before today's interview, a brief producer's note. Today's show was recorded in London and comes to us thanks to our friend Luke Robert Mason from Virtual Futures. Check out virtualfutures.co.uk to learn more about their work. Thanks, Luke. Now on with the show.
Today's guest, Richard Barbrook, is probably best known for his breakthrough essay, The California Ideology, which first exposed and critiqued the libertarian underbelly of our supposedly free-to-be-you-and-me internet. His book, Imaginary Futures, looks at the way fantasies of the future have been used to steer society toward particular, usually market-based and exploitative outcomes. So you wrote The California Ideology really 18 months into the Wired Revolution. And the Wired Revolution came really 3 or 4 years into the actual internet revolution and successfully recontextualized what I saw as a people's evolutionary, beautiful Siberian leap into connected consciousness, into just a reactionary effort to prevent digital technology or networking from changing the established power
structures. I think that was the European reading of it. So we were told we were anti-American, which I thought was quite shocked about. I then wrote another one, slagging off the Deleuze Guattari fans,
right,
called The Holy Fools, just to sort of balance it out. Because what we were trying to say, there's lots of positive things about American counterculture of the 1960s. You know, whether it's surfing or organic food or LSD or you know, not the Grateful Dead, but maybe some soul music we could go down. But you know, so there were lots of positive things about it, right? You know, anti-racism, anti-sexism, anti-homophobia. It's just that what they'd done is they'd taken that imagery, basically the look and feel of it, and then used it for a corporate agenda. And the reason why why I was aware of this, as I said, I was doing my doctorate in the early 1980s, and they gave me some money to spend a summer in the Bay Area, which I basically did research onto 1920s American radio in Berkeley University's library. That's what I did. But when I'm there, I met lots of people who first were people who were involved in the 60s rebellion, and then people who worked in Silicon Valley. I did remember meeting this guy who'd done acid with Steve Jobs, and told me how he was a sellout.
Yeah,
and there were lots of people like that you met who actually had kept the faith. You know, they'd stayed politically on the left. They were doing jobs like being school teachers or working in the health service, or if they were running companies, they were sort of more like co-ops than capitalists. And so they hadn't made large sums of money, so they hadn't bought into this other side. And what I thought was weird was meeting people who had been, I know, tear gassed by Ronald Reagan's police. And then you have this sort of strange mixture of, at one hand, they want to say, like Howard Rheingold wants to say, we're coming out of the hippie counterculture. But on the other hand, the people, very people who literally, in the case of Ronald Reagan, sent tanks against them, they've embraced their economics. And that's that strange thing where you get social liberalism with economic liberalism. It has been probably for the last 30 years a really strange mixture. I mean, 1980s in England, you know, Margaret Thatcher was an economic liberal, a neoliberal, but she was hating gays. You know, she, you know, passed homophobic laws, was, you know, they didn't like black people, they didn't like women's rights, and et cetera, et cetera. And so they were morally conservative and economically liberal. And what's interesting about the Californian ideology, as we called it, is that combination of social liberalism and economic liberalism, which has actually become more pervasive in the last 30 years. And certainly the last 20 years since we wrote that pamphlet.
You know, and it was more obvious, you know, back in the day when, say, Pepsi-Cola co-opts the hippie peace and love movement with "I like to teach the world to sing," it's a little bit more obvious that, okay, here's a corporation that's co-opting these hippie memes in order to sell sugar water.
The revolution is available on CBS Records.
Right.
With the MC5 with a mixture of guns and guitars.
Yeah.
That famous poster. A friend of mine, I remember, used to have it up on his wall.
But then, you know, and it sounded almost like you were talking about a friend of mine who was maybe the fourth employee at Apple, Dan Kotke, who was one of the people who used to trip with Steve Jobs, and then left the company very early on, you know, shortly after the Mac came out, left because it's like, oh my gosh, this is turning into this other thing.
Well, it's like Lee, you think of like someone like Lee Felsenstein, you know, where really where it comes from, home computing. You know, he wants to create, he basically wants to liberate the computer for the left. So, they thought there was going, you know, the American system was going to collapse, and in the sort of Mad Max universe, we'd all need our own little personal computers to survive.
Right, or Richard Stallman of GNU, who hates the open source movement because that's really just another form of you know, shared capitalism or something rather than anything genuinely distributed.
But I said that, so there is that. So you can have that sort of moral absolutist position, but I think we were trying to steer between the two.
Mm-hmm.
So you, not to reject it, you know, but to say, because we actually loved this technology. We were actually teaching people to learn how to, you know, make software, which they then would sell to advertising agencies for a living on things like this. So, you know, we're operating within the system, you know. So we like the technology, and the possibilities of it are amazing. It's just, well, what we disliked was being sold this as the ideology of it. You know, if you just say, well, this is the reality is, you've got to pay the rent, you need to put food on the table, you're going to have to work for the man at some point. You know, you might try and set up your own stuff, and that's really good, and people should try to do that. But, you know, but what we don't want to be told is when we're being selling our wage labour to create surplus value for the capitalist class, that somehow it is, you know, creating the Gaia mind. No, it isn't. It's capitalism, mate. Just shiny new, you know, 1990s or 21st century capitalism, whatever it is.
But isn't there, or at least wasn't there, an alternative? You know, when it was, you know, Fraser Clark of Evolution magazine and Howard Rheingold and the crazy little lefty hippie psychedelic users who were, you know, writing fractal programs on Sun computers before Wired magazine came and declared the attention economy and the long boom, and that the internet, rather than being the enemy of capitalism, which many of us thought it was, Wired said, don't worry, it's the savior of capitalism. Now you can invest in this. Wasn't that a turn, a detour? Wasn't that a turn for the worse? Can't that be corrected in some way? That's the way I felt that the California ideology that you wrote was exposing this, was exposing Wired magazine and Wall Street's co-option of the internet for an entirely
But it never was uncoopted. You know, I wrote this book, Imaginary Futures, about the origins of the internet.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what, you know, and the myth is that it was founded by hippies, but it wasn't. It's actually all these dodgy people who my father was on the right wing of the Labour Party and knew people like Walt Rostow, who was National Security Advisor to Johnson and murdered quite a large number of people in Vietnam indirectly. But also he knew Daniel Bell and all these sorts of people. I call them the Cold War left, because they were the left. They're in the Democratic Party. But and at home they were quite socially progressive, you know, civil rights and first environmental legislation in America under the Kennedy and Johnson administration. But as soon as you go abroad, they're genocidal, you know. There's carpet bombing the Vietnamese peasantry for daring to resist American occupation. And so that I find interesting. And so the internet comes out of this Cold War competition. Because they, you know, the Russians sent the first man into space in 1957, and the first woman into space, you know, and all this, you know, sorry, satellite man and woman, and then the Americans go, what's the next thing after the space race? And what the CIA identified was the internet, actually, in the early 1960s, because the Russians were talking about building cybernetic communism, and they report this, and so. They set up this thing called ARPA, and ARPA, what's ARPA supposed to do? It's supposed to stop the second Sputnik, second Yuri Gagarin, humiliation of the United States by the Soviet Union. And they identify the next point of humiliation is the internet, building a computer network society. And so this myth, I always thought that the myth of the information society, or what you would call your Gaia mind thing, came first and then the internet came afterwards. But actually, in a way, that you have to understand it goes much further back. It goes back to this Cold War confrontation between America and Russia over who owns the future. And if you identify the future as the network society, yeah, then the two people, they're racing to develop it. All that money, why did they spend all that money developing the internet? I never bought this thing about it's to survive a nuclear war.
Right.
You know, why would you replace cheap, reliable switches with expensive, flaky mainframes in the early 60s to create a communications device to survive nuclear? I mean, mainframes would fall over if you sneezed on them, let alone if you dropped a megaton bomb down.
Right.
So it was obviously that was just hokum. It's to do with this vision of who owned the future. And the fact that the Soviet Union abandoned trying to build the internet because they got scared that what it was going to do. And the Americans, it just kept this bureaucratic inevitability. They just poured all this money into it until eventually it escaped from the laboratory. So the hippie myth bit is really the bit between it escaping from the military-industrial complex before it goes into the corporate complex.
There was this moment.
Yeah, there was a brief moment which you loved.
Yeah.
We all loved. But the thing is, actually, it's more subversive now, the internet, than it's ever been 20 years ago.
Well, subversive in what sense? In the sense that Russians can hack American elections? Or?
No, the fact that we almost destroyed the Conservative Party in this last election. And that was, you know, it was Facebook which did it. You know, if anything, the most... So to explain to American listeners, so we've just had a general election. And at the beginning of when it was called about, and we don't have 2-year elections like in America, we have 7-week elections. The Labour Party was 20 points behind in the opinion polls. And almost the entire media absolutely hates the Labour leader, Jeremy Corbyn, because he's a socialist. I know this is shocking to Americans.
But like Bernie.
He's to the left of Bernie. Uh-huh. Right, he's a proper socialist. Uh-huh. I mean, Bernie's a socialist. He's a good, you know.
He tries.
Well, he likes Eugene Debs. I like
right.
Anyone who likes Eugene Debs is good enough for me. And he's Democratic Socialists of America. Very good group of people. Okay, so but he's like to the left of that, basically. So he's our leader. And all the mainstream media hate him. All the Tory media, right-wing media, and the liberal left
which
media.
Was very confusing. I mean, we were just talking about that before. The Guardian hated him.
Of course they hated
him. Why would they hate him?
Because he's a socialist and they're liberals. Yeah.
Guardian is supposed to be...
No, it's not. It's a liberal.
The left paper.
Yeah, exactly. So that's why they hate him, because he's gone beyond their... They're called the Guardian, because they guard what's permissible to be how far left you can go. And the BBC, which is supposed to be the state broadcaster, it's public service broadcasting, it's supposed to be balanced, and their idea of balance is to have, like, 3 Tories and 1 Blairite. That is a right-wing Labour. So we had all the media against us, and yet we managed to go, we got from being 20% behind to 2% behind. And instead of having a Tories winning a landslide, they've now got a minority government. Yeah, and basically will fall to pieces next year. And within a year, Jeremy Corbyn will be the most popular politician, and we're going to come to power on the most left-wing programme since 1945, within the next 18 months.
And isn't that partly a reaction to Trump and Brexit and all that?
No, it's to do with the fact that people have smartphones. And the fact that, you know, you can use, you know, people are doing blogs, people are doing Facebook posts. We made a game, another guy I know made a film, we made a game called Corbyn Run for the election campaign. It got 1.6 million impressions. Right, I mean, nothing we did 20 years ago. It had got anywhere near that sort of impact. This guy called Bonnie Prince Bob, who's a Scottish guy, he did a sort of science fiction film set in the future about the great Corbyn government. It's very funny. You will prove that, supposedly under a left-wing gay Labour government, every parliamentarian has to take DMT to make sure they have empathy with the population. It's a very funny. It's called Jeremy Bernard Corbyn, What Was Done. Right, it's a very funny film. He got 1 million views of this film.
But why does social media work toward these, you know, progressive and leftist coherent aims in England, but in the States, it feels as if social media is just this weaponized memetics, this destabilizing force that the more time we spend in social media spaces, the less coherent we are, the less we can make choices, the more we revert to our almost reptilian, automatic, fear-based activities.
Whereas here, we just laugh at it. Humor was a big thing on the left here. So this game is funny. The film is funny. There were lots and lots of memes, like little graphics for people making. But there's also people do very serious things. So what's most interesting, they actually had a thing of what was a statistic of what was the most shared article on the internet during the election. And the top two came from a blogger in Yorkshire called Another Angry Voice. The top two. And out of down below comes things like The Guardian, The Independent, The BBC. So The Canary, Squawk Box. There's this whole, like, plethora of these little blogger type things, and they are actually now they're getting more views, more shares than mainstream media.
But why? But why now? If just a year ago, Cambridge Analytica and all that money can send out memes and get England to vote against its best interests and Brexitize itself, apparently in the same style that America went for Trump. What's different now? In other words, why is the internet suddenly the friend of progressive thought?
There's something to do with the Brexit campaign itself, because you have to understand there wasn't a left voice in it. The pro-Brexit people were essentially the right wing of the Tory party. There was a small slither of Trotskyists who thought that England should become Cuba with worse weather. Yeah, but basically they had no voice in it. And then on the pro-Remain, the pro-EU one, it was run by Blairites, the right-wing Labour Party, and the then government. So a lot of it was just like an up yours at the government. A friend of mine who's a bus driver voted to leave because he hated the Prime Minister's posh accent. So that's the only reason. He just did it up yours. Though I did have an anarchist friend who said he voted leave because he wanted to fuck the system. And I told him, well, you're probably the only person who's going to be satisfied with the outcome of the Brexit referendum, because the Brexit's never going to happen. So the pro-Brexiteers are all going to be disappointed, and the Remain people are all in trauma because they're going to have to go through this thing, all this crisis until Brexit doesn't happen. Whereas my anarchist friend just is enjoying the chaos.
Well, chaos indeed. So you don't think Brexit will actually happen?
I don't think it's possible. We could have Beano. Do you know Beano?
No.
Oh, it's a children's comic here. B-E-A-N-O. But B-I-N-O is Brexit in name only. Where we pretend to leave the European Union, but we're still in it. That's basically what's happened after this election, because they were going to do what's called a hard Brexit,
right,
where we were going to suddenly be declare independence of the EU, and we're going to go back to 1900 when Britain ruled the waves and we had Empire 2.0, I think it's jokingly
called. Good luck with that.
And everybody, we're going to be the free trade capital of the world and all this bollocks. But that's not going to happen anymore. I mean, I think that went out the window in the election. So then they say, oh, well, we have to be a member of the customs union, single market. So once you do that, you may as well stay a member. I assume that's what's going to happen. It was a sort of fantasy moment. It's a bit like when they fired on Fort Sumter in 1861.
Right.
They had all these, what they called fire eaters, weren't they? The secessionists in the mm-hmm. South. And they just like this small minority, and they basically, when they managed to get to the stage where they provoke secession, in which case, 4 years later, Sherman's army came to liberate Charleston.
But you seem, rather sanguine about all this. In some ways, I originally experienced you as the guy who said, Doug, you got to pay attention to some of the bigger picture here.
I'm not sanguine about it. I'm just realistic. I realize, it's not...
But you're not apocalyptic.
Why should we be apocalyptic?
Because maybe it's all... we're destroying the planet.
Oh, because you're Mr. Trump.
Well, even before Mr. Trump, we have serious...
Ronald Reagan. The president's brain is missing. Oh, yes. And you had George W. Bush. The Republican Party just managed to produce amazing candidates for president, and then they elect him.
Yeah, and we're still, enslaving millions of people. We're still pumping millions of gallons of toxic things into our environment.
You're still stuck in the 1960s or 50s, probably. This is strange, America. It's like my mother. See, I have to explain. When I was a small child, I lived in America for a year in the 1960s. So. Which are the only things I can remember about this thing in my school. I could eat ice cream every day, even though it was -5 outside. That's centigrade, Celsius, I have to say. Whatever temperature. Fahrenheit, yes, I'm trying to think what it is. Fahrenheit you use, don't you? But she said, well, when they went to America in the 60s, 1960, it looked like the future. Everything was bigger and richer and everything, one more wonderful. And now you go to America, it looks like the past, which is strange. In 50 years, it's gone from being the future to being, it's been overtaken. I mean, I have Chinese friends who said this, you know, that they went to America in, you know, I'm sorry, they went sort of 1980s. And they were just thinking, this was what communism was supposed to be, you know, where everybody has a house and they have televisions and they have cars and, you know, everyone's got the vote and civil liberties. And now they go there and they go, ha, ha, ha. They don't even have 1 kilometre of high-speed rail.
Right.
And things like this, you know.
Well, we built the dream that we thought we wanted, you know, the Levittown FDR New Deal dream happened and we ended up.
But you didn't carry on evolving.
Right.
So this means the next, you know, I mean, obviously England has got lots of problems, but if you compare America to, say, Northern Europe, you know, like Germany, Scandinavia, it does seem very backward.
Oh, it does. And it not only is it backward, but our people are voting to bring it back more.
Well, make America great again. Some of them. I think the real thing which comes out of this election we had here is a lot of people don't vote because they see no choice. And one of the things we did in this election is prove if you offer them a left-wing choice, surprise, surprise, large numbers of people will turn up to vote for the first time. Not just young people, because there's this thing now, it's the young people, they bribed them by offering them free tuition, you know, no, abolish tuition fees and whatever, you know, we were offering them all these freebies, you know, free money. But actually it's not, it goes right up to people in their 40s. And it's because people who just thought, that why bother voting? I mean, I canvassed in the 2010 election when the Labour Party was still basically Blairite, and people would say, you're all the fucking same. You
know, I mean,
and they were true. It's like, which neoliberal do you want? Do you want a slightly pink neoliberal? Do you want a sort of centrist neoliberal or a conservative neoliberal? But it's three types of neoliberal. As the anarchists would say, whoever you vote for, the government get in. Or neoliberalism. And now we've got to a stage where you can start to offer, with people like Jeremy Corbyn's wing of the Labour Party here, or Bernie Sanders in America, you can actually start to say to people, there is a choice. You don't have to put up with this shit anymore. And, you know, there are these democratic mechanisms, and if enough of you go out and vote, you can change the system, particularly if you don't think it's just about voting, but actually you have to get involved at a community level in your trade unions, making culture, all the rest of it. And that's actually what powers it forward, because there's no way, you know, a few hundred Labour MPs controlling the House of Commons are going to change this country. But if we have already 750,000 members of the Labour Party and millions of people voting for it, and you actually mobilise them, then neoliberalism would collapse tomorrow.
And that is what's starting to happen in the States too, though. Now we're getting thousands of people, you know, volunteering women to run for office who've never considered it before, people joining parties, people joining labor unions, credit unions.
Exactly. We need to rebuild all that. I mean, the neoliberals deliberately smashed all this up. And a lot of the left just ran around, because they were obsessed with things like identity politics, you know, me, 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 I'm the most oppressed. And what you have to do is rediscover class unity.
The right wing is playing identity politics too.
Oh, no,
Trump's people are...
They're the best at identity politics. They love identity politics. It's not surprising that Richard Spencer embraces identity politics, is it? Yeah, I mean, that's what happens if you go down that route.
Well, it feels like the one thing you really can't change is class, finally, though.
No, and it is about class. I mean, really, you know, I was very involved in radical politics in the 1980s here, and we were pioneered a lot of this stuff about... you know, we were very focused on things like this is a multi-ethnic, multicultural city. Let's celebrate immigration. You know, my son is, his mother is an immigrant. You know, this is where everybody, it's the original city called the melting pot, actually. Mm-hmm. And it is London, is the original melting pot. So this is, you know, this is something to celebrate. We got absolutely monstered by the Tory media because we said respect our gay brothers and lesbian sisters. And things like people with disabilities, all these other... But the purpose of it wasn't to create little separate groups all going, I'm more oppressed, but actually to unite them together, to stop people being divided over race. You know, so why, you know, we had a very strong fascist movement here in the 1970s. And it was trying to do that, saying, you know, pitting white workers against black workers. And we see it now with Brexit. You know, white people, actually one group of white people hating another usually, because it's Poles, you know, now they hate Poles and Latvians, you know.
It's the thing I never understood about fascism, why they even call it that, because the word fascism is all the different strands coming together into one thing. Shouldn't fascism be multicultural?
Well, that's because it was in the fasces was originally a symbol of the left. Obviously it's originally the Roman Republic, but the fasces, as you point out, which is it's lots of sticks stuck together, was adopted as a symbol first in the French Republic, and then later, particularly in Italy, where he got it from. It was about things like peasant unions were called fasces. So, but you have to understand, he started on the extreme left. Mussolini was the leader of the left of the Italian Socialist Party. A bit like Lenin. He started on the extreme left and ended up as a dictator, as a fascist. Lev Landau, that was his famous quote, which is that Lenin was the first fascist. And he meant that starting on the radical left, and then by seizing state power, precisely because you come from the radical left, you're not constrained by bourgeois democracy, liberalism, and therefore you end up being more right-wing.
So for the most part, though, would you see digital technology as a distraction from the basic real-world community building that we need to do in order to achieve power?
No, it's a tool. I mean, I'm old enough to have lived in the world of analog technology.
Right.
And I always feel like the technology's actually caught up with us. So this friend of mine who's the opposition finance, John McDonnell, is basically the number two of the Labour Party here. And we worked together on community radio broadcasting when the left ran the council, Labour left run the London Council, Greater London Council, and we set up community radio station. And we used to, I've been reading lots of stuff about France and Italy. We used to talk about building the electronic agora. Agora electronique. Uh-huh. And the idea was you somehow, you know, obviously, because we're in a social democratic party, we're electing people to be councillors, but the idea is how do you mobilise the people outside, you know, your voters, your party members, and it seemed like community radio was a way of breaking the spectacle, you know, so it's not just us sending messages downwards through the media to the masses, but the people can actually start to run their own lives. And that's the importance of any left political project. It's not just to replace one bunch of bureaucrats with another bunch of bureaucrats, but actually to shift power and wealth from the few to the many, as we said in our slogan.
Right, which is why the net seemed to do that, at least on the surface.
But the technology doesn't do it by itself. Yeah, the technology is a tool. And we fight over that tool. As you say, the corporations will try and make it into one thing. We want to make it into another. And as I said, it's interesting that, you know, if you even look at something like, you know, Facebook, which is, you know, one of the biggest corporations now, it provided a platform for people to actually bypass the Tory media, the BBC. The BBC and the Tory media and the Guardian, it's just, we hate Corbyn, we hate the left, blah, blah, blah. You know, don't vote for them. We want a Tory landslide. I mean, you have to understand, the Guardian wanted the Tories to win big because then their friends would retake over the Labour Party and they'd all be nice and safe and neoliberal again. The Hillary Clintons.
Right.
They even have a woman called Yvette Cooper, who is basically Hillary Clinton.
Right, the same way the New York Times wanted Hillary and would not want to understand Bernie. Bernie didn't get space.
They preferred Trump to Bernie.
Right. But they certainly preferred Hillary to Bernie.
No, they preferred Trump as well.
Well, for their...
No, what they want, it's like the French, the recent French presidential election. What they want is, you know, they want a sort of a social neoliberal against a fascist neoliberal. That's their perfect election, where most of the left are then forced to vote for the less awful neoliberal. But you don't have a choice. You have to vote neoliberal. What they don't want is a socialist. That's really what they don't. Because once you have a choice between socialism and neoliberalism, the socialists could win. And then suddenly they might have to pay more taxes.
But as you as you expose me to in books like Science of Coercion, which you sent me, and a number of others, neoliberalism is embedded in America's. And I suppose Europe's too, but America's internationalist movement of the 50s, 60s, and 70s.
Well, it actually came later because originally it was a sort of Fordist movement. You have to think originally they were in favor of big government. Big government and big business were allied together and they started to separate really in the 1970s, 80s, when basically Wall Street reasserted itself. You have to say, obviously, up to the 1914, the First World War, capitalism, particularly its Anglo-Saxon, as the French would say, versions, was dominated by the banks.
Right.
Yeah. You know, if you read Marx's Capital, it's all about how the interest rate in the city of London is a determining fact, regulating fact. But then with the First World War and the Second World War, you get this big government being a key part. So if you look at the sort of writings of the 1940s, 50s, 60s, and really into the 70s, really what they want is this sort of enlightened bureaucracy working with the corporate. And in fact, lots of the corporations are seen as quasi-state. You know,
back with the National Association of Manufacturers.
Yeah, exactly. And then that breaks down and you get this reassertion of
Wall Street, because investors were more powerful than the corporations themselves at that point.
Well, it's also because they wanted to create a global system. And if you want to have a global system, you can't have America has various failed attempts to invade countries like Vietnam and Iraq. So it doesn't really want to directly run it. So if you have to, you know, if America had a next Europe and we were voting in your presidential election, that the big government may have stepped up. But if you want to have a global system, you have to shift it away from the state to the banks. And now the banks become a regulatory system for a globe. And that is the shift that goes on. And the internet fitted with that California ideology, because you suddenly say, oh, the state is terrible, even though the internet is entirely created.
Right, or John Barlow saying, governments of the world, get off our net. This is for us.
Which the governments of the world had created for us.
Right. Nowhere in there does he say, corporations of the world, get off the net.
No. No, so then in big business and big banks become the new way of and of course the other advantage is no one elects the head of a bank or a corporation, and so you can see this in the I said lots of the Brexit vote was imperial nostalgia and racism, but part of it was this fear, was this dislike of the way that neoliberalism basically removes democracy. So if you want to unite Europe, for instance. Instead of having a European Parliament, which we all vote members of, and then that vote, that then creates a European government, which is somehow accountable to the people of Europe. What you do is you create marketization, because then the unification process is controlled by corporations and banks, which obviously are accountable to no one, except to their shareholders. And they shit on the rest of us.
So then why or how does Russia end up on that side? Russia was originally the communists.
Why? When?
When Israel wanted to partner with them on the kibbutzes. When
they wanted to join the West, didn't they? That's what the KGB always wanted to do. They were, it's not surprising that the KGB, Yuri Andropov, Gorbachev, Putin, that's what they came out of. They come out of the people who'd gone to the West and thought, well, why can't we be like that? Why can't we join them? Putin was brought into power to get Russia ready to join the EU. And we so pissed him off, he's gone and joined the Chinese instead. They wanted to be part of the West. He's the most pro-Western leader since probably Lenin or Peter the Great when he came to power.
And how did we piss him off?
Because the Americans didn't want him to be part of the West.
Wouldn't it have increased American Western power?
Because they were afraid that Russia and Germany would come together, isn't it? It's Halford Mackinder. They will read the geographical pivot of history. If you read, whether you take it any seriously as a theory, but it's very influential in the American foreign policy establishment. Have you read this?
Mm-mm.
Oh, right. So he has this. So he was a geographer. He wrote before the First World War and says, if you look at a map of the world, the world, basically the centre of the world is Eurasia. Yeah, that's the centre.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have what's called rim nations. Well, you've got, which is like Britain as a sea-bound nation. And then, of course, then later America. Yeah. So what they're afraid of is the unification of Eurasia, and then America is on the wrong side of the world. So you have to split Europe from Russia. That's if you read some of their stuff, that was ever. Of course, the funny thing is they've actually pushed the Russians into the hands of the Chinese. The Chinese can't believe their luck at the stupidity of American geopolitics, because what they want to do is build across. Obviously, they want to build this Silk Road across Eurasia.
So then Trump, by trying to partner with Russia in spite of their failings, is a correct move.
Yeah, but it's too late now. I think it's a much more short-term thing. The American political establishment need an excuse to build all those useless for F-35 aeroplanes. It's a boondoggle, isn't it? It's right. Money. It's just a shakedown money for the American taxpayer. So you need an enemy. And really, Al-Qaeda, despite its best efforts of the Saudis and Islamic State, aren't really an enemy, because if you actually made any effort on them, you can wipe them out. Whereas Russia isn't like quite a big country. They've never forgiven the Russians for not being commies anymore. That was the worst thing they could possibly have done, is take down the red flag and a hammer and sickle. Yeah, they'd love Russia. You know, if they declared that they were Stalinist again and they put up the flag and all started doing May Day marches, the whole American foreign policy establishment would run around cheering in the sky, wouldn't they?
Yeah, now all we've got is Islam.
Which is not, yeah, which, well, no, Wahhabism. They're not Islam, because most Muslims absolutely loathe these people.
Yeah, I know.
Because they're the number one target of them. So yeah. All Shia hate them. All Sufis in the Sunni tradition hate them. They're Wahhabis. During the siege of East Aleppo, the recent siege of East Aleppo, which the West was supposed to, we were all supposed to be crying tears for these poor people being besieged. And I have a lot of Muslim students whose parents come from South Asia, Middle East. And how many of them supported the rebels in Syria? Guess. Out of zero. They were all pro-Assad, which I find is a bit scary, given I used to work with, in the 1980s, I worked with this socialist who'd been tortured by Assad's father's regime. He was a Syrian refugee here. But they all the Muslim students were just like, kill the whole fucking lot of them. No mercy.
And is that because they're the wealthy?
No. They're poor. They're working class English Muslims. You know, they're just fed up with all this Islamophobia they're faced with, and these crazy people committing terrorist atrocity. And as far as they're concerned, they're Saudis. They'd happily string up the entire Saudi royal family, probably personally, from the nearest lamppost.
Do you think there's a compelling reason for working class Americans to understand the geopolitical scene, or is it enough for them to get involved locally and improve their local economies, be less dependent on global supply chains and corporations?
Well, they said wars are the way of teaching Americans geography. Well, you have to be. I mean, you're a long way. I mean, the thing is, you know, America is the biggest island in the world. It's a long way from everyone else. And most Americans don't have passports. So, you know, but you are the global superpower. So Americans have to be interested in it. You know, again, you know, you say the Muslims as if they're a homogeneous group. I mean, they don't have a pope. You know, this is the most, you know. I mean, they're even more squabbling than the Protestants or the Jews. You know, there's dozens and dozens of different types of Islam. Yeah.
No, there are dozens of kinds of communism. I mean, but it's still Islam now serves as, I'm just saying, it serves as a mythical enemy. Word to have an enemy for.
But they're not really serious enemy. But the Soviet Union was a serious enemy. That was a proper enemy. I mean, actually, actually had like military power and nuclear weapons and, you know, was organising revolutions or supporting revolutions in the south. I mean, you know, Al-Qaeda is a bunch of few thousand Saudi-funded nutcases, and ditto Islamic State.
But if you had a metric for measuring American fear of a people and an idea, it's quite possible that the level of fear of Al-Qaeda or ISIS is as high as it was of Russia back in the 60s.
Well, they managed in one terrorist atrocity to probably kill more people inside America than anyone had for a very long time. Mm. I mean, that's the key thing. But, I mean, that was a long, long time ago. And anyway, you didn't go and attack Saudi Arabia, who was most of them were Saudis. That's what everyone... In all the conspiracy theorists, you think there's a field day. Uh-huh. You know, Al-Qaeda was set up by the CIA. Let us not forget. I had a minicab driver once who was an Afghan refugee, and as he was driving me home, he said, I met Osama bin Laden when we were both working for the CIA. And I said, well, I'm glad you said that, not me. He was in a different faction, but he was actually an Afghan. So, but that again, that's that sort of complication. It's like, you know, you get into this world of conspiracy theories and tinfoil hatting, so... That's the other problem. You know, if there is, people are interested in geopolitics in America, but there's so much disinformation. You know, the one thing they've learned, the establishment in America, deep state, I think they call it nowadays, the deep state has learned is to produce lots of disinformation to hide what the real things in plain sight are.
Right, which makes it hard to follow the global news and
there isn't any global news in America.
There isn't, right. And what am I supposed to do? Read my Guardian updates, which now you're telling me the Guardian's not even the Guardian anymore.
It just reproduces the NATO line on Syria and Ukraine.
Right.
Their coverage of Syria was appalling. and also Ukraine was terrible as well. I mean, again, you don't have to like Putin. I mean, he's an authoritarian conservative. But to just demonize this country, to then start apologizing for rather disturbing Wahhabi head choppers in Syria, it seems to me a bit of a strange position to take if you claim to be a liberal paper.
So where would you send people to get their global information?
Well, you just have to browse the internet and have a look. Not InfoWars.
Not Alex Jones, no?
No, Doug Rushkoff, I'm sure.
There you go.
There, you have to provide it.
At least if you come to me, you'll get honest confusion.
Well, that's a good start. Well, that was Karl Marx's motto, was doubt everything. That's probably the first place you should start.
Oh, good.
Well, certainly if it's published in the New York Times, you should definitely doubt it. It's probably a lie.
Thanks for joining Team Human. We'll be back in the Basement Media Squad here at the Laboratory for Digital Humanism again next week with new strategies for human intervention in the machine. This show was produced and edited by Stephen Bartolome.
This is Stephen here. It's been another great week of support coming through our new Patreon campaign. I'd like to thank all of our new supporters. Again, a reminder that patrons have exclusive access to our Team Human Slack channel. There are a number of interesting conversations going on alongside the show over at Slack. Again, go to patreon.com/teamhuman to support the show and join the Slack channel. Membership cards will soon be mailed out. I'd like to thank our friends at Zago who generously designed the cards for us. Check out teamhuman.fm to learn about the music you heard on the show, more details about this episode, and ways to get involved. My name is Stephen Bartolome, and I'm on Team Human.
And I'm Douglas Rushkoff. Team Human. Our last best hope for peeps.